Those of you with an inquiring mind and more than a passing interest in the environment, which hopefully accounts for the majority of us, may have enjoyed a visit to an exhibition at the Manx Museum earlier this year called Hear Us, Sounds of the Sea. Bill, there's a chance to discover the sounds beneath the surface of the waters surrounding the Isle of Man and gain a new appreciation of the island's rich and varied marine life. The Hear Us project does all that, but actually goes much deeper, if you'll excuse the obvious pun, into the cultural being of the Isle of Man and its waters and the influential connections between those who live and work on this island and the life and well-being of the amazing waters which surround it. An exploration, if you will, of the local human-marine symbiosis. Whilst the exhibition finished some time back, Hear Us is an ongoing project aimed at bringing together artists, musicians, researchers, and members of the public to make underwater recordings around the island. By listening to sounds beneath the surface, it's hoped to garner a new appreciation of the island's rich and varied marine life and a deeper awareness of the human-made sound pollution that threatens it. The project was inspired by the 1950s short stories of Wirral-born writer Malcolm Lowry, who visited the Isle of Man as a child and later wrote about its natural beauty and the need to care for the seas which surround it. And it took its title from the Manx fisherman's hymn, Hear Us, O Lord, from Heaven, Thy Dwelling Place. And in this short programme, we'll hear a little bit more about this fascinating project from some of its key players. All you have to do is hear us.
My name is Dr. Alan Dunn. I'm a reader in art and design at Leeds Beckett University.
I'm Helen Tukey. I'm a poet and a writer, and I'm a reader in creative writing at Liverpool John Moores University. So we've actually been running a project in Liverpool based around Malcolm Lowry since 2009, which was the centenary of his birth. Lowry was born on the Wirral, just over the Mersey from Liverpool. And there was sort of a group of us there who really liked his writing. And we wanted to do something to celebrate that. So we sort of kicked off in 2009 with an exhibition of sort of artworks inspired by Lowry and a set of events. And they were really well received. Lots of people were interested and we all felt there was a lot more to explore. So we carried on every year doing an event about Lowry. And he's best known for his novel Under the Volcano, which was published in 1947 and set in Mexico, sort of just before the Second World War. But sort of later in his life, he became really kind of interested in writing about the natural world. And he was living in a sort of hand-built shack on waterfront near Vancouver. And one of his neighbours there, in another shack, was from the Isle of Man, who was a boat builder, Manx boat builder called Jimmy Craig. And This, coupled with the fact that Lowry knew the Isle of Man from family holidays as a boy, this was what made him kind of start thinking about the Isle of Man again. And so, yeah, he wrote this set of stories which were published after his death, which uses the Manx fisherman's hymn, "Hear us, O Lord, from heaven their dwelling place," as a sort of framework. And the stories are in different ways about the sea. They're about kind of the natural world. They're about sort of threats to the natural world. The sort of Isle of Man kind of threads through them, really. One of the stories has a Manx protagonist. And there's this sort of figure of this Manx boat builder who is almost like a kind of spiritual guide, really. So we've been doing this ongoing Lowry project for quite a while and exploring a lot of aspects of his work.
It was the cleanest, the coldest, freshest, most invigoratingly beautiful water I have ever swum in. And at low tide, the mudflats themselves were interesting, seething with every imaginable kind of strange life. Tiny, slender, pale turquoise starfish, fat violet ones, and vermilion sun stars with 20 pointed arms like children's paintings of the sun. Barnacles kicking food into their mouths, polyps and sea anemones, sea cucumbers 2 feet long like orange dragons with spikes and horns and antennae, lone strange wasps hunting among the cockles, devilfish whose amours sound like crackling machine gun fire, and kelp with long brown satin streamers. When they put their heads up and shake them, that means the tide is slackening, Quaggan told us.
It was really Alan's idea to come up with a specific strand of the project that kind of did focus on the Isle of Man. So I'll let Alan say a bit about that.
All right, take it away, Alan. So how did you come up with this idea of then coming to the Isle of Man and doing these sounds of the sea?
It actually seems quite obvious now. We thought we would sail to the Isle of Man. I live on the Wirral, and you can sail to the Isle of Man from the Wirral. So we got some funding. I actually sailed to the Isle of Man myself and wrote the funding application at sea. So it was very appropriate. And I'd never been to the Isle of Man before that first visit, but my mum and dad had, and there was sort of lots of connections. They'd sort of travelled from Glasgow there. So we got the funding and we started sailing to and from the Isle of Man, bringing with us other poets, writers, artists, musicians, environmentalists to create a series of podcasts, getting to know the Isle of Man and some of the people there, and including some of the ferry passengers. And we were staggered by the hospitality, to be honest, and willingness to talk to us, and a lot of the ideas and issues discussed with us, from taxi drivers to wild swimmers to bands to record shops. So we're really excited by this. And one of the people we invited was Chris Watson. Chris is one of the world's leading sound recorders, well known for his work with David Attenborough and Bill Oddie. We invited Chris on one of the trips, and he wandered off, as he does, and he lowered a hydrophone into a beautifully tranquil, quiet Douglas Bay, thinking there'll be nothing, and all of a sudden this whole underwater world exploded sonically. Chris obviously knew this, but for me personally, it was a real ear-opener in terms of, well, wait a minute, there are all these sounds here we're not capturing. And we're meeting people from the government and Blue Carbon and Biosphere. And they started saying, well, 85% roughly of the Isle of Man is actually marine territory, is underwater. And how can we engage people in what we can't see? How do we get them to worry about it or be just aware of it and passionate about it? We thought, well, listening underwater is a very obvious way. So we got some more funding to come back specifically to bring some of Malcolm Lowry's texts back to the island and introduce them to the public via the museum display, but specifically to drop our hydrophones around the whole coast of the Isle of Man and start listening. That was the project in a nutshell.
And it's a fascinating idea because it brings in, it's sort of multidisciplinary, it brings in all sorts of different strands from, as you say, literary and cultural and scientific and environmental. And was this sort of the aim to a degree to help, as you say, by particularly using the sounds from the recordings to engage people with the importance of the marine ecosystem, as it were?
Yes and no. I'm of a visual arts background, so I've got an awareness of how images, still images, moving images can, you know, allow people to talk to each other and gain knowledge and have fun and, you know, have different relationships with your immediate environment. And more recently, actually since meeting Chris, I've been aware of how powerful sound can be, listening to each other. Our first phase of the project did take place during COVID, where a lot of us could hear a little bit more of the world and each other. So that was a little bit of a coincidence, but we went to the Festival of the Sea, and just to see the look on people's faces, from toddlers to pensioners, of listening to these incredible sounds of limpets or shrimp or dolphin or seaweed and lots of unknown sounds that we've no idea what they are, to be honest, because they don't come up and introduce themselves. It's like listening, hearing for the first time. And it's a sense that we use above water and have lots of regulations, obviously above land, about, you know, noise and how we talk to each other and, you know, listening for safety and navigation. And we've simply said, well, actually, if 85% of the Isle of Man is underwater, let's explore this as well. So we thought with our experience that using the Malcolm Lowry connection and the underwater recording, very practically putting headphones on people's heads, would open up some new dialogues. And we did workshops, how to make your own hydrophone and how to, you know, put a bath bomb in a tub of water and listen to that. So you can do it at home, basically. So it's the joy of listening to what you can't see really kind of was at the core of the project.
And do you think you did inspire people through the workshops here? Do you think people were inspired to go out and maybe experiment themselves? Because as you say, it's a real problem when you've got an ecosystem on land. Everyone can see it. It's very easy to highlight the issues there. When you've got something which, other than scuba divers, no one's going to be able to see it. It is difficult to highlight the importance of a submarine environment, I suppose.
Yeah, we had people come to the workshop who afterwards were really enthusiastic about sort of taking their hydrophones and going out and listening into the sea. And actually, we've had some people send us recordings that they've made. You're really right about that idea of sort of engaging people, and that's kind of what we're talking with various people on the island still, like from the Wildlife Trust, maybe from the government, about ways that we could make it a little bit more of an ongoing thing. So you know, perhaps the idea of even having a sort of a kind of a live streaming, you know, streaming sound from underwater, so people can really get a sense of wow, you know, listening to what's there.
And were you aware, you mentioned, Alan, that there was all sorts of sounds that you didn't know where they were coming from, natural sounds, but also, of course, that there's man-made sounds which are travelling out into the marine ecosystem as well. And I think it's been highlighted around the world. These can have, it can be marine pollution to a degree, or, you know, audio pollution, which can cause problems for the likes of cetaceans and such like. Were you sort of more aware or surprised by that?
A little bit, yeah. We were, again, really honoured to be, we were able to invite Chris Watson back, and we actually hired a boat from Discover Diving to go out and record, you know, from off the coast. They gave a talk at the Manx Museum, and he played some of the sounds that he recorded. And he noise pollution is, as you can imagine, his number one enemy. From, we even took the steam train one time, and he just pointed at sheep and said, "Sheep have ruined so many of his glorious recordings." So sheep, and all underwater, they were actually scanning the surface, I think, for possible wind farms at the time, Howard. And so Chris is really, really aware of, obviously, sound travels much further underwater, and he said the impact can potentially be colossal. So our project was very much an awareness. I was personally unaware how far, how loud. We saw a distant speck of a fishing boat. And Chris lowered his very expensive hydrophone under and said, underwater, and let us listen, and said that engine slightly out of sync. You could hear this incredible frequency and disturbance. And if we're hearing that, then obviously our friends in the rest of the natural world are perceiving this, feeling it, the vibrations, what we call hearing it. It was beautiful working in Isle of Man because it's an island, because it's the coast is so important. And we went to all 10 marine nature reserves and met so many local people, for which, you know, there's a real, real love for the island and an interest in sort of protecting it, but also exploring, you know, a lot of that kind of unknown territory. So it's been a real kind of educational project for me personally over the past few years.
And do you think this presents a unique way of engaging more people? Because obviously with environmental issues, they're quite often presented sort of in one dimension, as it were, just purely from an environmental perspective or a scientific perspective. This is multidisciplinary. We're taking in, as you say, we're taking in literature, we're taking in art, we're taking in music, we're taking in the environment, it's a much broader scope. Does it engage more people? Do you think this is a very useful way to make people more aware of these sort of issues, what they have and what impact they might be having on it?
For me, I think that's a really key question. I remember, I think as a public, as a species, we get very quickly sanitized to things. I remember a long, long time ago seeing a mural in New York of a fish with a beer can, you know, plastic ring around its body. And this was the start of, you know, raising awareness of plastic pollution. Very quickly, I think those images became quite cliched, and we were sort of dealing with similar updated versions of that. But I think you have to keep ahead of the public. The public become quite, and I include myself in that, quite kind of used to one particular type of awareness image or public information image, and you have to constantly move on. So that, yeah, very much part of the project was to take some literature from the 1950s with state-of-the-art sound recording with Chris, with engagement workshops, working with an incredible range of artists over the few years, even exploring shipwrecks off the island, to recording different types of times of day, different times of year. So piecing together, we're not scientists, we are artists and poets, but we've been working with people who know their stuff on the island, obviously. So yeah, I think that's again, personally, that's my preferred model for, it's very much an engagement, public, fun, as you say, multidisciplinary approach to some of these issues.
I was just going to say, I think another thing that's quite relevant is if you can actually kind of get people doing stuff in a quite an active, you know, like a hands-on kind of way. So you're not just sort of talking at people about something. But like Alan was saying, if you give people a set of headphones and a hydrophone and say, drop this down and listen to this, you're really kind of engaging people in the moment. And, you know, that's a completely different way, I think, of doing things. And one of the things that the Isle of Man government, one of the government sort of ministers was saying to us from the outset, really, was, you know, we've got all of these marine nature reserves, but what we really want is to find a way to kind of engage people with them more, because we've got all the information on the website, but that's quite dry, you know. So, I think finding ways that you can actually enable people to sort of be, you know, standing in the water listening to something, or you know, doing like we with Rowan Henthorne from the Blue Carbon, we did a seaweed pressing workshop, and Rowan was you know, talking to people, just fascinating on the subject of seaweed, and you could just see how engaged people were by just getting a new way of seeing what's kind of there, really, I think.
My name is Rowan Henthorne and I work on the Blue Carbon Project.
I'm Jackie Keenan, I work on the Blue Carbon Project at DEFA. I think the easiest way to compare it is with the stuff on land. So there's a pretty good understanding that trees and plants on land absorb carbon and they store it away in the soil underneath them. And that's what happens in the sea as well. So animals and plants in the sea absorb carbon as they're living, and either as they poo or as they die, that carbon goes down to the seabed and is either locked away or it goes back into the carbon cycle. So blue carbon is carbon that's stored in the sea. So we have ecosystems like seagrass, kelp, and shellfish reefs, and they all are some of our blue carbon ecosystems.
So it's a bit like sort of we hear sort of carbon sequestration on land and things like peat bogs. It's sort of similar to that, but under the sea.
Yeah, I think that's the case with a lot of science in the sea. You look out at this blue expanse and a lot of people don't know what's going on at the surface. But the really exciting thing about blue carbon is that once it's actually locked in those systems, it's much harder to re-release because it is under the sea. Whereas on land, you can, you know, things can start on fire or just naturally degrade and release that carbon. In the sea, it's a lot harder to do so. So one of the reasons why blue carbon is so important.
It is a fascinating project, it has to be said. You mentioned, I think you'd like it to be ongoing. Clearly these things are often dependent on funding and such like. Is it, are you going to be able to continue with it?
Yes, I believe so, Howard. Yeah, I think we've made all the sounds recordings. We've sort of chopped them into sort of greatest hits, put them on a website, and we've spread that around the island. And I think one dream for me was to have maybe some bands or poets download these sounds and incorporate them into, you know, mixes and compositions. So the recordings would have an ongoing life. We had a meeting this morning again with the Wildlife Trust about possibly coming back. Another sort of, again, a more focused underwater recording aspect. So they have some underwater GoPros with their video footage. But I think hopefully one of the things the project has made people a little bit more aware of what sound can do. Video is great underwater, but to get good quality sound is we're quite used to, and again, sorry, name drop Chris again, he bemoans the fact on TV if we see underwater footage or wildlife, there's a tendency to drop panpipes or string orchestra music over it. That's really not what it sounds like. So we're actually saying, actually, it sounds kind of interesting, very abstract sometimes, but there's a kind of, to hear the shrimp and limpets, and it is a kind of conversation and music. The sound is actually, you know, they're communicating for reasons the same the way that we do. So to listen to that seems quite normal. We'll never understand in that sense what's going on. But there's something very, very sort of humbling and human about listening to our natural world friends communicating.
Anything to add to that?
Only to sort of confirm what Alan was just saying, that we're sort of hoping that we will be able to find some ways to kind of carry on working on the island, partly because we just want excuses to come back because it's lovely, but also you know, like Alan was saying, lots of people on the island, the Wildlife Trust, the government, are really on an ongoing basis keen to kind of use this idea, especially sound. You know, like Alan was saying, it adds a dimension that we're kind of not used to, and So yeah, we are sort of hoping that we'll be able to find some ways to kind of continue it, which is exciting.
Well, listen, best of luck. It's a fascinating project. We've just sort of tiptoed into the shallows there of what's going on. Hopefully, we will see you back on the Isle of Man in the not-too-distant future to continue with this. In the meantime, if people want to find out a little bit more, you mentioned a website. If people can see more, hear some of the recordings, where's the best place to go?
It's very simply malcolmlowry.com. So MalcolmLowry, one word, .com.
Thank you very much, the pair of you, for talking to us today.
Thanks, Howard. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.